This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse was done on September 20th of 2005. It contains John's commentary, titled Robber Barons, Rebels, and the Socialist Challenge, which considers chapters 11 and 13 of People's History. A discussion session follows the talk. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes anti-copyrighted talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording.
Okay. Tonight we're going to talk about the robber barons and rebels and the socialist challenge. As I was going through the chapters in my notes, I was thinking about what a field day Jon Stewart on The Daily Show would have with some of the comments in this chapter. If any of you have not been watching The Daily Show, especially last week when they were doing material on creationism and evolution, and of course they always get in some really fine shots against Bush and the regime in power. And given what's on most of television, including the cable channels, they're actually getting away with some amazing, amazing comments about this society in power. Far, far more biting than even the original cast of Saturday Night Live in the mid-70s, which did some wonderful work. I can see Chevy Chase doing the news now when he used to talk about President Ford. I mean, they had a great time with Jerry Ford. So let's talk about the robber barons. And again, for those of you who are familiar, I'm just going to try to highlight some things, and then we'll take a break and we'll open it up. The term, as you know, robber barons, comes out of a particular period in U.S. history. I mean, we don't call these people robber barons anymore. They're financiers, industrialists, entrepreneurs. They never call them capitalists, of course, which was a term that was widely used, especially in the 1930s. And the term robber barons actually comes from a book by Matthew Josephson, which I believe came out in the 1930s. People saw clearly what was going on. So this first chapter is a discussion of the economic and political elites post-Civil War who really took hold of the country. And as Zinn argues, organized the greatest march of economic growth in human history. I mean, the U.S. economy just exploded post-Civil War, from the Civil War, especially to World War I. Of course, all of this wealth was created by working people and then appropriated by Carnegie, Rockefeller, etc. We have to remember that. And given the nature of this book, of course, Zinn reminds us of this over and over. The great use of free black labor, Chinese labor, especially in the West, to build the railroads. In the East and all the way into the Midwest and up into Minnesota, in the mines, Southern and Eastern Europeans, increasingly women, and stratified in a labor force by class, by gender, by race, and ethnic origin, which dramatically divided working people in the country. And some of you may have seen the fine film done on this theme called Matewan by John Sayles. It's a film about an actual strike in Matewan, West Virginia. M-A-T-E-W-A-N, marvelous film about a strike, strike breakers. You know, they import African Americans and Italians to break the strike. And I won't give away the story, but it used to be done all the time. That's one of the themes that he discusses. He also talks about the Horatio Alger rags to riches myth, that those of us who are older were certainly raised on it. You know, you're born poor and you work hard with luck and you're going to become wealthy and powerful. That myth, of course, undermined by sociological data, would show us even then people who became fabulously wealthy came disproportionately from the middle and upper middle classes and thus got a nice little start on their way, though some of them, of course, did start from very humble beginnings. Outside of Ithaca, New York, where I used to live, there's a little town called Richford, New York, and there's a little historical marker. It's where John D. Rockefeller, the original John D. Rockefeller, the man himself, was born in 1838. And he started in a quite humble little town, which is the sort of the northernmost part of Appalachia. It's a very poor town. So you have the development of incredible wealth. You have immense industrial projects going on. You have the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And of course, throughout all of these marvelous things that were being done, you have literally the death of thousands of people doing this work in the mines and the railroads, the blood and sweat of people who did the work, including the Chinese who helped build the western part of the Great Transcontinental Railroad and who were forced to work through the winters digging tunnels and other parts of the railroad out here in the West, and thousands of them died and were injured. So when we think of progress, which is one of the themes in this book, we also have to think about the staggering human cost of the progress that we have in this society, that it has always involved human labor and it has always involved triumph and tragedy, depending in the railroad, the factories, the mines, and a loss of life over hundreds of years that few of us know about and the media rarely examine. Surprise. So we have the development of the major industrial corporation in this period, ruthless competition, keeping wages low, despite the myth of free enterprise and being a hardworking entrepreneur, of course, all of these guys got government aid. They didn't call it welfare. Remember, welfare is only for black mothers with kids and poor white mothers. But all of the major wealthy individuals of that period and the corporations and the banks, and especially into the 20th century, have been incredible beneficiaries of government aid. This system and these folks would collapse in 1 week without the taxpayers' aid. We're not talking about small businesses here. People open little businesses here in Santa Monica and LA and all across the country. I mean, you see them. You drive up Lincoln Boulevard and other places. There are just thousands and thousands and thousands in this city and area. Those people don't get the major aid in the country. They don't get any aid at all, basically. But we're talking about the major corporations, the tax write-offs, the insurance policies, etc. So it's really a myth. It's one of the great myths in our society. And so talking about welfare, in fact, there's a nice little paperback book, I forget the authors, Taking the Rich Off of Welfare, because that's the biggest welfare group in the country. Zinn tells us that in many ways the government was acting exactly as Karl Marx predicted, pretending to be neutral and help all, but actually serving the interests of the ruling class. That's something that the US government has done since 1776. And if you have any doubt about it, just read James Madison, John Jay, and Alexander Hamilton's essays in the Federalist Papers. Long before Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto and Capital, James Madison wrote Federalist Paper Number 10 around about 1787 during the Constitutional Convention, arguing for support of the Constitution at that time. Also read the financial pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the LA Times. I mean, to really find out what's going on in the country. Actually, I'd make a plug, by the way, speaking of financial pages, because I think he's the best financial writer I've ever read in any of the major newspapers. That is Michael Hiltzig of the LA Times, who does some absolutely marvelous articles, and his articles on the hurricane and government aid and what's been happening, and his articles on Social Security. Marvelous for a mainstream American newspaper. I think he's consistently better than Paul Krugman of the New York Times. Michael Hiltzik, Hiltzik, he's got a column called The Golden State twice a week in the LA Times, right on the front page of the business section. And as is my practice, when I read things that I like, I send people emails. Hi, you know, bravo, I really loved your column, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'll usually the first time sign it, titled Professor Emeritus, State University of New York. So he got back to me. He used to be a reporter in Albany, New York, where my daughter works. He went to Colgate University in upstate New York, where I have friends who teach. And so we had a little discussion about New York State and, you know. But his columns are marvelous. And he's also been doing some very tough columns about our governor, their governor. So Zinn goes on to talk about the reforms that begin at the end of the 19th century. It's called the Progressive Period. That's how I learned it as an undergraduate history major, the Progressive Era. So wonderful things were going to happen. Zinn's argument is that essentially what happened is that the worst of the economic ills that were emerging after the Civil War, people had to reform some of them, but basically to make sure that those who were in power stayed in power. And he's got some of these marvelous quotes, one of them on page 260 by a banker, a New York banker, who was toasting the Supreme Court, which of all the institutions in American government has been the most fundamental defender of economic power and private property, even more so than the executive branch, I would argue, and Congress, in which this banker is toasting the court as the guardian of the dollar, the defender of private property, which essentially is wealth created by working people. The Supreme Court has been this way on class and economic issues since the beginning. If you read a history, any decent history of the Supreme Court, and I would argue it's naive to believe otherwise, and that includes the period of the most liberal era on the Supreme Court, the 1960s and 70s, the Warren Court, Douglas, Hugo Frank, Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, who were fine on other issues. But when it comes to fundamental economic issues, they're basically there to support corporate power. There's also some discussion of the powerful and profound issues of corporations becoming persons, and that's discussed marvelously in a great documentary, which you can get out on DVD and video, called The Corporation, which was here, I don't know, last year, 2 years ago. Marvelous film, a little long, but it's wonderful the way they lay it out, so that we end up in a society in which corporations are persons. Okay, and the 14th Amendment was essentially created to protect the rights of newly freed black slaves. So at that period, especially in the late 19th century, you have the Supreme Court of the United States defending the rights of corporations and into the 20th century, rather than defending the rights of black people in the South who were being terrorized by the KKK and other white supremacists. An amazing, amazing, amazing irony and contradiction. And then, of course, he shares this statement by Supreme Court Justice Brewer in 1893, again about private property and the power of the state. And it's really just a variation of John Jay, one of the founding fathers, one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, who made a comment that the founding, that those who own the country ought to rule it. He was right. They do own it. They have ruled it. And so that quote is actually the quote I'd like to see. I may even send a little note to John Stewart at the Daily Show. He's Supreme Court Justice addressing the New York Bar Association. You can imagine what kind of a group that was in 1893. It is the unvarying law that the wealth of the community will be in the hands of the few. The great majority of men are unwilling to endure that long self-denial and saving which makes accumulations possible. Couldn't you see John Stewart doing an interest? You read that quote and then showing some of these corporate executives with 5 or 6 homes, 12 jets, 4 yachts, you know, buying $4 million this, $3 million that. They're always just saving, saving. That's how they become so wealthy. They just save all those little dollars. So again, and that's, you know, again, this is not, see, once you look at American history in a certain way, this should not stun us. That's been the tradition since the first court in 1789 under John Marshall. This gentleman, Brewer, is really reflecting class consciousness at its best, something that he and those people in power know. It is the only class-conscious group in this society. It's the rest of us that have been kept mystified and brainwashed against understanding that. And so, of course, when working people, especially people in the lower and middle classes, get organized, get upset, get angry, and try to do something, they're accused of fomenting class warfare. Okay? Well, the upper class has been doing this for 230 years. That's not class warfare. That's in the national interest. Of course it's class warfare, and it's class consciousness. And that's why they run the society and we don't. Now, as Zinn points out, keeping this class control in a formally democratic society is a real tough job, okay? I mean, this is not El Salvador, though at times it has been El Salvador and Guatemala, especially for racially oppressed groups, all right? And so they also have to engage in what's called hegemony. It's a Greek word, really means domination or influence. And Zinn's arguing that those in power also have to influence the institutions in society other than the military and the police, influence the churches, the schools, and the media, which is probably the most powerful institution fostering class rule in this society. And when you go back and read the history, especially of the rising labor ferment and the populists and some of the progressives from the Civil War to World War I, which was some of those stretches, the most militant strikes in U.S. history, incredible battles between working people, National Guard, Army units, shutting down parts of cities, shutting down the railroads, the farmers, you know, raising hell, as that one quote, you know, raise more hell and less corn, one of the activists argued. Militants in farming that was repeated in the 1930s, but has not been repeated since then. Well, in order to maintain domination in a society, you cannot always, in this kind of a society, you cannot always resort to force. And the notion of hegemony comes from the Italian Marxist and communist leader in the 1920s, Antonio Gramsci, who was sent to fascist jail in around 1925, 26, where he was there for 11 years and then died shortly thereafter. He argued that in the West, in Europe and elsewhere, you had to try to figure out how was it that the ruling class maintained power without consistently relying on, you know, beating people in the head. And so when you look at the history of this period, you'll find that overwhelmingly, of course, until the early 20th century, most of the clergy in the country would condemn people who raised hell and went out on strike, and they condemned unions as being against the interest of people. And of course, the educational system was part of this. And the whole rise of the educational system, especially in the late 19th and early 20th century, when you have the rise of the common high school in the United States, really is to organize curricula and to have teachers help to reproduce these dominant views in order to try to sort of disabuse people of certain critical ideas. But the critical ideas come through, as he shares with us. I mean, it was a volatile period. I mean, you got people like Edward Bellamy, Henry George writing, Upton Sinclair. I mean, there are things that some of us read a long time ago. I mean, it was a period of amazing ferment, and especially as the century turned in the first few decades of the 20th century, which included the great surge of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, especially from Russia, Poland, and Italy, mostly into New York, and then a huge surge of Chinese immigrants into the West Coast until that was cut off. It was also, as Zinn points out, a start of major decades of strikes by working people, union and non-union, in the late 1870s through World War I. The effort for the eight-hour day, okay, that really begins in the United States. That's the significance of May Day in the United States. May Day, May 1st, is celebrated as a holiday for working people throughout the world, by the way. Not in the United States, where now it is Law Day. Okay, it's actually called Law Day. And I remember in the town where I taught, Cortland, New York, driving down Main Street in Cortland, small town, about 20,000 people, and there's a big banner across Main Street, you know, celebrate Law Day. I mean, working people are lucky they get Labor Day off. I never expected, I was in a union, I never expected we were going to get May Day off. But that's an American tradition. And he discusses the whole struggle and what happened in Chicago on May 4th, 1886, in the Haymarket incident. Interesting date, of course, May 4th, 1886, the Haymarket strike, and then many decades later, May 4th, 1970, the shooting of the students at Kent State. Great upsurge in the country, strikes all over the place by skilled workers, by unskilled workers, battles in Homestead, Pennsylvania, which is kind of a little part of Pittsburgh, at the Carnegie Steel Plant. Pinkerton Guards called in. And at times, of course, the National Guard, the Pinkertons, of course, private army, at times they would call it the National Guard, but National Guard people come from the communities where the workers lived, and of course, then they couldn't even rely on the National Guard to take care of people, so then they'd have to call in the army. He talked about 1893, and until that time, the greatest depression in U.S. history, a massive depression, in the midst of the greatest economic boom in the history of the country to that point. One of those remarkable, mystifying contradictions of capitalism. Amazing plenty, just incredible, incredible, as today, and amazing want in the midst of amazing plenty. It is the fundamental contradiction of this system. And you get a sense of that when you leave the country. I remember 20 years ago, I spent 4 months in the then Soviet Union. I lived in the dormitories of Moscow State University, and there was almost nothing in the stores. I mean, you know, people were well-dressed, there were no bag people, there were no people grabbing things out of garbage pails, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone was, even in the cold of the Russian winter, people were well-dressed, even in difficult times. But then coming back to the United States and going to a major supermarket like Ralph's or whatever, and walking down the aisles, talk about culture shock. I actually walked off one of the aisles, that is, I measured off, it was 90 feet of just beer. And we have too much. I mean, that's the fundamental contradiction of this system, that we're just clogged with things, and yet there are, by minimal estimates, perhaps 40 million people poor, disproportionately children. We have estimates I've seen from 2 to 5 million people are homeless, et cetera, et cetera. So this is going on in the late 19th century. And he discusses the rise of the American Railway Union at that time and socialist leader Eugene Debs, who would later run for president, an effort by and the part of some people to fight for a truly open union of all working people. The problem is in the United States is that the American labor movement has been crippled by two very fundamental factors, the most fundamental being a racism that kept unions closed to black, Latino, Chinese, Japanese people who came to the United States. An absolutely entrenched racism that was enhanced by people like Samuel L. Gompers and other labor leaders. Right all the way up through the 20th century. All the way up through the 20th century. There's also a discussion of the Prairie Radical Movement, the Farmers Alliance, the Populist Party. I mean, when you add up all these things that are going on in the late 19th, early 20th century, on a stretch of 20 or 30 years, it's truly extraordinary what was happening in the United States in terms of both power and repression and resistance. I mean, we often, for those of us who are old enough to remember, have been activists in the 60s. I mean, there were things going on in some of these decades that made the 60s look pretty calm, actually. Because, I mean, you got stuff going on everywhere. I mean, you got the farmers and the workers, and you got immigrants coming and people organizing in New York and Philadelphia, and things are happening here. And, of course, the great danger in the South, you know, a possibility, the Populist Party trying to get some blacks and whites together, which is the greatest fear, of course, for the ruling groups in this country at that time. If oppressed racial minorities in the United States organize with white working class people, it's all over. It is all over, folks. And of course, blacks being terrorized. I mean, it was a reign of terror. I mean, we've discussed that with the rise of the KKK, the rise of Jim Crow laws, the total after that little stretch of Reconstruction. In the South, the Union forces withdrawn, the South rises again. So you have a potential threat to owners in the South, owners in the North, and you even have places, I mean, it's interesting because this Thomas Frank written this book recently, Whatever Happened to Kansas, that, you know, Kansas has become this right-wing fundamentalist state. I mean, Kansas was one of the hotbeds in U.S. history. During the abolitionist movement, I mean, John Brown went out to Kansas, but also during the populist movement. Farmers were raising hell, and of course kept raising hell right through the 1930s. And one of the ways, of course, that this system is so powerful is that they can indirectly undermine those struggles. You don't have to send in the army, you just economically devastate farming communities in the country. And so millions and millions and millions of people, of course, have been pushed off the farms from the late 19th century. I mean, we know perhaps mostly about it in the 1930s in the Grapes of Wrath, but it's continued. It's continued. So there's a dramatic drop in farm population and people who have individual farms in the country. So that's why you have the rise of activists like Mary Leese. She's the one who told farmers to raise more hell and less corn. She argued Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, but a government of Wall Street. There are 30 men in the U.S. whose wealth is over $1.5 billion. Those guys would be pikers today. Ooh, what are you kidding? Those guys would shop at the 99-cent store like I do. You know, essentially Wall Street with other connections, finance capital, industrial capital, have owned the country and essentially have powerfully influenced the government. Actually, there's a marvelous book called Every Man a Speculator by Steve Fraser. It's a history of Wall Street in the United States. And we're talking, it goes back more than 200 years. Fascinating history. And especially when you get into the 20th century and when you get into the Depression. I mean, there were folks wanted to hang some of these guys from the highest lamppost, given what happened and how the whole effort of Wall Street and major media to recreate people's faith in the economic system. Marvelous, marvelous and interesting book. Of course, we're all aware, especially the last 25 years, in terms of the division of wealth and poverty in the country, that I come across statistics that are so staggering that, you know, I have to read them two or three times. I mean, some UN statistics that, you know, the wealthiest 200 billionaires in the world are worth more than the 50 poorest countries on the planet. Okay? Ooh, all right? So despite all this agitation, you have sort of countermeasures, a classic divide and conquer strategy that was used to divide working people, and people like David Redeker, who's done marvelous work, and others, Noel Ignatieff, who wrote a book, How the Irish Became White. We talked about some of that back a couple of months. Is that the tragedy often is that white working people in the country chose being white over solidarity with black working people. And so their effort to maintain their racial edge was more important to them than getting in solidarity with people who are at the same economic category. And that is still with us. Of course, Zinn comes back to a theme that he's discussed in other chapters. Of course, also the use of patriotism by McKinley, President McKinley, to undercut class struggle, just as with race, you know, showing the flag, getting people's minds off of what's going on at home, and especially in the South, which has a long, long tradition of service to the military, especially by white working men. And you find that right, well, throughout the history and especially post-Civil War. And then he sort of segue into the next chapter, Chapter 13, for tonight, The Socialist Challenge, and quoting one of his favorite people in history, Emma Goldman. He actually wrote a play about Emma Goldman, hitting the truth when she stated that the lives, blood, and money of the American people were used to protect the interests of American capitalists as a way, especially in wartime, but also in peacetime. And essentially, that was one of the reasons why Eugene Debs was thrown in jail, spent many years in jail, for making a speech about these kinds of issues, basically arguing that the rich create the wars and the poor die in them. The poor fight them and die in them. But the two are linked. When you read this book, you know, when we move back and forth between U.S. domestic policy and U.S. foreign policy, there's a link. And it really emerges internally and then moves outside. Tremendous, and now we're talking especially the early 20th century, absolute explosion of socialist and radical literature. That period, of course, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Jack London, the rise of the Muckrakers, and of course, for those of you who are born and raised here in California, know something about the history of Upton Sinclair. It's a history that I'm reading more and more about in the years I've been here. I mean, he almost became governor of California in 1934, and they went crazy, the Hearst papers especially, red-baiting him to make sure he didn't come to power. There's a little discussion of the sort of the internal workings of American corporations in this period. Zinn discusses the work of Frederick, very briefly, Frederick Winslow Taylor and the scientific management movement, which really arose in the country in which Taylor was hired by U.S. Steel. It wasn't to scientifically organize work in the country. His job basically was to scientifically organize the management of other people's work so that they could increase efficiency but make sure that those running the corporations continued to run. And we've seen a relentless effort in the last century continuing of what's called de-skilling of work that didn't start with Taylor. I mean, it actually started earlier in history. And there's a marvelous book on the whole issue of work in the United States and Taylorism written by Harry Braverman called Labor and Monopoly Capital, The Degradation of Work in the 20th Century. Braverman traces the profound changes in factory life in the United States after Taylorism onto the modern office economy, which increasingly we have the new economy, term first coined by Ronald Reagan, which is really the white-collar version of what Taylor did at Bethlehem Steel in the early 20th century. And it's really to organize the hierarchy of work in the interests of a few and to de-skill, continually de-skill the labor, especially of craftspeople. And while that's going on, again, you've got all these other movements. You have millions of people coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, especially. The three major countries sending immigrants were Italy, Poland, and Russia. And some of them, of course, becoming involved in the building of a radical and socialist alternative to the system in this country. The struggle of the working poor, captured marvelously by that brief quote that Zinn has by the English romantic poet Percy Bysshe Shelley from his poem, The Mask of Anarchy, which was written in 1818 after the English army slaughtered could be thousands of weavers at Peterloo near Manchester who were protesting brutal conditions in the mills. The effort of the owners to introduce power looms into the mills, which would then destroy the craft skills of the weavers. And from that period, by the way, comes the pejorative term Luddites. And I'm sure some of you have heard that term. Somebody said, well, what are you, a Luddite? It means, you know, you're anti-technology. You want to smash computers, break machines. You're disgusting. Yeah. Well, the term, as most terms that not are terms of endearment that we have today, when we actually go back in history, we find out that what we were taught about those terms almost always turns out to be the opposite. The Luddites didn't just go around destroying machines per se. They went specifically at those machines and at those factories where owners were introducing the power looms and throwing them out of work. They were trying to defend their craft skills. Shelley's poem, by the way, ends with these lines, "And that slaughter to the nations shall steam up like inspiration, eloquent, oracular, a volcano heard afar. And these words shall then become like oppression's thunder doom, ripping through each heart and brain, heard again, again, again. Rise like lions after slumber, in unvanquishable number, shake your chains to earth like dew which in slumber had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few." Now there was a man who could turn a phrase, all right? He was joined at this time in his protest against what happened to these workers by his romantic poet colleague, George Lord Byron, whose first speech in the House of Lords during this era was to condemn the crushing of workers in England who had been opposing the use of power looms to undermine the craft skills of mill workers, referred to negatively in our time as the Luddites. Byron, and just an aside, I mean, probably the three greatest romantic poets in the English language, Keats, Byron, Shelley, all dying at a very young age. Byron in the struggle for Greek independence. Shelley drowned near the bay near La Spezia in Italy. Keats died of tuberculosis. I actually have been at the Keats-Shelley Museum, which is next to Piazza di Spagna in Rome, right up the block is a McDonald's. It's a museum, and you actually look. I was with a friend who's a romantic, many years ago in Italy, a romantic poet, scholar, who was there, and actually looked at Keats' last letter under glass, and Shelley was there when he died. So they spoke as poets to what was going on. As Zinn comments on the horrendous working conditions, and virtual slaughter of people in the mills and mines and other sites in this society. And we know, because we have voluminous evidence of investigation after investigation that revealed what was happening, and that conditions only improved. And we go back to one of those chapters when we quoted Frederick Douglass. They only improve by the struggles of workers and their allies. No struggle, no change. No struggle, no gain. No pain, no gain. It wasn't that the owners sat down and said, and the plantation owners in the South talked to each other, well, Joe Bob, you know, we're exploiting black people and becoming wealthy. We should change our ways or God's going to strike us dead. It didn't happen that way. It didn't happen that way. It took the rise of unionism, even though, of course, the union movement was very racist and very sexist, also keeping women out. It did not, for decades, move to truly organize workers, regardless of race or gender, unlike the rise of the industrial workers of the world and the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which arose in many ways in protest to the AFL-CIO in the 1930s during the Great Depression with the sit-down strikes. So you have radical workers and radical unions in the IWW and socialists challenging the mainstream unionism and capital itself. But those movements were defeated, and Zinn goes into that. And so the AFL then, and I would argue that the AFL now, essentially remains very reformist in nature, understandably wanting a piece of the pie, but accepting the fundamental pie as it is. But yet at the same time, unions, those actually organizing trade unions and working people and their allies, are key to every single reform in the history of this country in the 20th century. Every single thing that we now take for granted in terms of health care, social security, etc., were fought for by working people. But it's been a profoundly limited movement. All right. The IWW was crushed, people were arrested, people were killed. And, you know, Gompers is having dinners at the White House with presidents at the same time. So I say this sadly because I grew up in a union family and I'm still a union member. I'm a member of the American Federation of Teachers, which is our parent union. It's the University United profession within the State University of New York. So that the idea of one big union where everybody's organized has not come to be. But it was an amazing period because, as Zinn tells us, you have a real rise of the socialist movement. Thousands of socialists were elected to office. Perhaps a million people read The Appeal to Reason, a little paper that came out weekly until it was shut down in the mails by the Attorney General. It was published in Kansas, of all places, you know, not the Lower East Side of New York. You had people like Debs. You had Helen Keller. Yes, Helen Keller was a socialist. I mean, I remember we all learned about Helen Keller in school and, you know, saw that movie with Patty Duke and Anne Bancroft. And who the hell knew that Helen Keller was a socialist and a radical? So when I, you know, first read Zinn, and then my students would read Zinn, and I mean, they all learned the, you know, the usual story about Helen Keller, and they thought this was made up. You know, she's kind of radical, hanging out with Big Bill Haywood and talking about tearing down the system. Helen Keller? I mean, what are you kidding? And so we emphasize her physical disabilities, not her politics, and her argument about the electoral system we have in the country, you know, voting for Tweedledee and Tweedledum, the need for militants and demonstrations far beyond the ballot box to change the country. I would suggest nothing fundamental has changed that would have caused her to doubt her assertions were she alive today. The socialists and feminists of that time, Kate Richards O'Hare, Emma Goldman, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Margaret Sanger, all of them faced very intense attacks on their person for their socialist views, but especially even worse because they were women speaking out ahead of their time about the ills of the time. Mary Mother Jones, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, especially black women and other oppressed racial minorities who faced immense suffering. And so you have this tremendous ferment and pushing in a way, but at the same time, these left radical movements being seriously, seriously compromised because of their attitudes around race, especially. And there's some marvelous historical scholarship that discusses that. He writes very briefly, and we've talked about this person I'm going to mention previously, arguably the foremost intellectual activist of the 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the founders of the Niagara Movement and the NAACP. Du Bois was a socialist, and later in his life became so disillusioned with the United States and what was going on, he left to live in Ghana and joined the Communist Party later in his life. He was always accused of being a communist. They took his passport away. They harassed him in the 1940s and 50s, especially Du Bois and Paul Robeson, who also had his passport taken away. Du Bois actually ran for Senate in New York State on the American Labor Party ticket. And one of the sad moments in history is they just found out at the Great March on Washington on August 28, 1963, they actually found out at that day that Du Bois had died that very day in Africa, you know, at that moment when 250,000 people were in Washington. There's a brief discussion of the so-called progressive period in American history and some discussion of Gabriel Kolko's analysis, fine historian who's done some marvelous work on the history of war and also the American economic system. And I believe his book on the progressive period is called The Rise of Conservatism or The Triumph of Conservatism. One of those books that we didn't read in our history classes when they were discussing progressivism because we just were taught that Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and all these guys were just wonderful, peachy keen. Kolko's argument is that reforms actually took place that were organized and pushed by those in power in order to deepen the control of the corporate class and not fundamentally change anything. So Roosevelt and Wilson, of course, were the preeminent progressives. Roosevelt ran for president on the Progressive Party ticket. They essentially would be called liberals today, though try to find anyone in the Democratic Party who will actually say, hey, I'm a liberal. And they are. They are Kerry, Clinton, Biden, etc. But boy, you don't hear anybody whispering, ooh. So people had to move on the worst aspects of the emerging corporate order in order to save the system against itself, which is exactly what happened 20 or so years later, 30 years later, with the Great Depression. Franklin Roosevelt used to lament all the time that his fellow capitalists hated him. They thought he was ruining the system. People wanted to kill him. They wanted to tar him. They wanted to feather him. And he kept saying, I'm just trying to save the capitalist system. You know, he just tried to get people to see that's what he was doing, and that is what he was doing. And they, you know, they had to make some changes. As the old French saying, things have to change in order to stay the same. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, it's an amazing period. I mean, some of the stuff, some of those moments, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York, there have been programs, the rise of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. My grandmother, Rosina Seminara from Palermo, Italy, was in that union. I never met her. She died before I was born. She was in that union. That union was overwhelmingly composed of Italians and Jews. And it was a very militant union at one time, sort of as part of that now in the SEIU, the larger union. So it was quite a period. So let's take a break and take 10, stretch, and then let's come back and talk about these things. We can open it up and have a discussion.
Sure.
Ask you a question about Karl Marx. There was a special on television in the year 2000 where they
had a program about the 100 most influential people of the millennium. And the number one person that they chose was Johann Gutenberg. And they based their findings on how these people touched the individual lives of people in the last 1,000 years. And of course, Gutenberg makes sense because of the printed word. And then the other top 10 figures were scientists like Newton and Pasteur. Mm-hmm. But number seven, and the only philosopher they picked, was Karl Marx. Hmm. And I couldn't understand it. And I shook my head, no, come on. Karl Marx, with all the failures of communism and socialism around the world, based this on the fact that they believed that Karl Marx was the first philosopher in the world to give the working man a sense of empowerment. Do you agree with that, and do you think Karl Marx has had an influence on the American labor movement?
Number seven, wow, that's actually was Mickey Mantle's number for the Yankees.
Yeah. And, no, seven out of 100 surprised me, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Pope John Paul came in with something like 85 or 90.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think of some of the lines in the Communist Manifesto about working man in the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, written, of course, with Engels. I think in terms of social and historical movements, that some would argue have been profoundly distorted by followers. In fact, I probably could make the same argument about Jesus of Nazareth, whether he was a real figure or whatever, that these ideas evidently move hundreds of millions of people over history. And yet, when we discussed what some of Jesus's followers did in the West Indies with Columbus, Marx, of course, virtually all of his writing had to do with just the past and his present. I would argue that he is the preeminent diagnostician of industrial capitalism, who, of course, couldn't see certain things that would develop a century later, and that there's been a big debate in the 20th century, people using his name, especially in the Soviet Union and elsewhere, to engage in monstrous kinds of activity in the name of Marx and in the name of socialism. But in terms of a theoretician, but also an activist, because he was involved with working groups in Europe, though he spent year after year after year in the British Museum and elsewhere writing notes and doing work, which I think goes to 50 volumes, by the way. It's extraordinary. So I think that's an accurate place in history, regardless of what may have happened in the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, in China, in Vietnam, because he really said virtually nothing about the future. His analysis in Capital and German Ideology and all these other volumes is really about how did this system develop, what's happening, and of course in the manifesto is a polemical pamphlet basically urging working people, really working men, to organize and to fight this system and to ultimately overthrow it. And if you read, by the way, some of the lines in the Communist Manifesto, read as if they were written today, about globalization, capital tearing down cultural barriers, what is the line, all that's solid melts into air, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that this engine of capitalism, the most dynamic economic system in human history, without a doubt, and Marx wrote very laudatory things about capitalism, it was everywhere in the world, and it has been for centuries. The idea that globalization is new is actually nonsense. It's just deepened, and of course, the things are faster. I would argue that if people need to understand some of the fundamental dynamics of this system, they do need to confront his views. I mean, it's like trying to understand science without reading Einstein. I don't think it's possible. But for those of us raised here in the U.S., you know, I was in high school in the 1950s, so Marx, I mean, you know, Marx for us was the Marx Brothers, you know. I actually have a great T-shirt, by the way, that I should wear it. It's called, Sure, I'm a Marxist. And it's got Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and Karl. Yeah. And
as I read the chapter 11 about the robber barons, my stomach was upset because it could be written about this moment. And it feels, because I'm doing this election justice stuff, impossible to make it swing back. And the guns are more cruel than the people in power. And we have to ask Howard and you as his proxy, okay, now what? I mean, and comparable tightening of power and money and government is, well, it's just overt in a way, maybe it's not been. But could you, do you agree, and then now what?
That it's...
The similarities.
Oh, the similar, yeah.
Of conglomeration and the government. You know, Robert's biggest thing in, if he gets on the court, is pro-corporate,
oh, yeah.
Anti-people of all kinds. It's just,
yeah, I mean,
it seems overwhelming.
Yeah, it does. I mean, believe me, I hear you. And I'm not as an optimistic person as Howard Zinn is. I mean, I'm sure Howard has his moments. But at the same time, when you look at this history and you realize, you know, what people were up against in the 1870s and the 1880s and in the 1890s and, you know, up to World War I and then the Depression and some of the things, you know, our parents saw and our grandparents saw, and we know that their struggles and their resistance made a difference in that time and now. And I guess you have to take a long-range view, because if you take a short, let's say even a shorter range view, when you think about, let's say, up to the point when Nixon resigned, you know, I have this image, remember he was saying goodbye with Pat on his helicopter. I guess he was going to San Clemente, right? That was the Western White House. When you think about that, I mean, and the ferment coming from the 50s, 60s, 70s, And it appeared, wow, you know, coming out of the Vietnam War, real changes had been made in civil rights laws, and it seems that we've gone backward. But not completely. There's no doubt, because I think that, I mean, there's, in terms of your comment about John Roberts, and he is going to be confirmed. There's no doubt about that. And there was a little thing on the internet today about, oh, the Democratic folks who might be running for president in 2008. That was Biden, Evan Bayh of Indiana, Hillary Clinton, and someone else are really angry. They're in anguish now about how they're going to vote because the Democrats don't want to appear to be obstructionists.
Oh my God.
And so, and they don't know who Bush is going to nominate. You can imagine who might be in the, you know, they had a little clip about Bush looking across the table at Attorney General Gonzalez and making a comment, well, maybe even Alberto might be a, but Gonzalez, by the way, is too threatening to the right-wing fundamentalists. Imagine that. Ooh, there's a guy who said torture's okay. He's not good enough. It's clear that the Supreme Court is going to be continue its very rightward move. But again, if you look back at what the Supreme Court was in the 1870s and 80s and 90s, we have come some distance.
Our electronic elections won't allow it unless we overturn them. It's fixed forever now, unless we get the fix out. So the hope of taking it back with the people with the guns, because they control the electoral machinery, secret and private, it seems even more hopeless. That's where my question comes from.
Well, it's a question, what you mean in terms of, because a lot of times I see on the internet, or I see in Jim Hightower's little newsletter, which I get, the lowdown, and I see speeches, especially during the campaign, we have to take our country back. It has never been our country, okay? It has never been our country. And I would argue that while people should fight on every front, including the electoral front, because we still do have elections in the country of a sort, the fundamental changes, as Zinn has discussed in this book, have not come from the ballot box. They have never come from the ballot box. They have never come from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in a sense, was moved by history. It's not an accident that this Supreme Court is far to the right of the Warren Court, because that's what the country is like in a certain way. And the bottom line is, regardless of whether there appears to be hope or it's hopeless, you have to do what you have to do to keep your sanity and to look in the mirror every day and to keep trucking. I mean, you have to do that because, you know, as you said, they're up organizing, screwing people over early in the morning. I mean, they don't sleep late. They don't sleep in like we used to in college, right? You know, well, I remember some of my students, well, want to change the system. They used to sleep till noon. Are you kidding? The guys already had organized half the country by noon.
I just wanted to say I'm on the threshold of some kind of a huge change because I've been with you, you know, talking about everything we've won through resistance and fighting. And in fact, with Hurricane Katrina, I had the idea, you know, and the March in Washington planned this weekend with buses going in, and I had this vision of similarly hundreds and hundreds of buses carrying people into New Orleans, I was going to say Los Angeles, to resist the land grab in New Orleans. I was getting all excited about the possibility of something like that becoming organized, and then a teacher of mine pointed out to me, and I know it to be true, that every resistance engenders a counter-resistance, and it goes on forever. It never stops if you use that kind of a strategy. I really feel at a deep, deep level that that has to stop. I asked this person, who's my teacher, I've told you about him, Roger Weir, I asked him, so you don't believe in putting one's foot down and saying, this is where it's got to stop because it's not right. We won't let you go any further. He said, yes, I do believe in that. I believe it's important that, you know, in Thoreau's civil disobedience writing, I believe in that. However, it has to take place within a larger context. And I said, what's the larger context? And he said, well, it has to be done by means of a strategy of a different kind of resistance, a kind of resistance where one convinces the other side that they're acting against their own best interests, and it would be in their own best interests to change their tactic. And when he said that, it sounded correct to me, and yet my heart just sank, because I don't know how to do that.
Well, I don't know whether any of us know exactly how to do any of these things. I mean, think of all the experiences we've had in this room in various ways of trying to come to grips with things, trying to deal with feeling a sense of hopelessness, being depressed, being elated, etc. So, I mean, no one has any, I mean, no one's an expert in any of this. But at the same time, we do have some sense from looking at what has happened in the past. And I would say respectfully, I mean, I don't know all of his views, you're just sharing some of them. But I would argue that if that's this gentleman's theory of how history changed in the United States, he is profoundly, profoundly wrong. Because, and again, just think of the civil rights movement. For centuries prior to the 1950s and 60s, African Americans and others acted in certain more passive ways and prayed for help and made pleas to those in power to act as good Christians and to treat people decently and to allow our people freedom and to let us vote and to stop lynching us. And those pleas, except for a few, because within a group of people, there are white people in the South, I forget this guy's name, who was an activist in the Klan in the 60s and 70s and just had this rebirth and then was going around the country with an African-American woman from North Carolina doing programs in high schools. I mean, wow, talk about a... And white people of conscience were moved by what happened, not just in the 50s and 60s, but throughout U.S. history, to see that, one, morally, it was important for them to be in solidarity with those being oppressed, but that ultimately, you're right, it was in their interest, because we then live in a decent, more humane society, and then we grow from that experience. But, I mean, I wish that history wasn't true. You know, I wish it didn't happen. But we know that as a group, slaveholders, corporate owners whose minds were grinding the lives of men and women down and, you know, living on the mansions on the hill, making the plea that it was in their interest just fell on deaf ears. And I would argue that they do understand in ways that we do not that it is not in their interest to change, because if they do, they're not going to be living on the hill owning the lives and sweat of other people. You can't be in the plantation if, you know, and that's tragic, and it seems to be so constant in human history that maybe we think it is, we've had this discussion about human nature, that at a point they can't change. They have to be moved. I think that's one of the lessons of this book. And Zinn would argue you should do that in nonviolent, civilly disobedient ways, marches and demonstrations and people writing letters and speaking and sitting down and whatever, because he's known war and he thinks it's insane. And so how do we find, using Thoreau and King and others, creative, nonviolent ways without having any illusions that the people in power will respect those rules of the game? And I think the most recent example is that, I call it a human rights movement, is what we saw happen in the southern United States in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s. And I was thinking about it because I went to the post office and there's a new issue of stamps. There are 10 of them on the civil rights movement. One of them is, there was a little thing in the LA Times about the Little Rock Nine, okay? The nine African-American, black African-American teenagers who stared down the Klan and vicious whites and police in Little Rock, Arkansas in September and October of 1957 to go to Central High School. And it took the force, Eisenhower was forced to call out, I think it was the 82nd Airborne, to take over for the National Guard to ensure that these kids went to school. That's how things changed in the southern United States. And they changed by thousands of people being arrested and people being killed and being thrown off their farms, because the racism was so deep, so poisonous, that most of the overwhelmingly whites would not change. And, you know, I wish it were not that way, but we have to deal with what actually happened. And that lesson to me is that those who want to maintain that system of racism or other power can't transcend it, not as a group. There are a few individuals that will, but not as a group, not here, not in this country, not from this history.
John, hi. You mentioned before in passing about a linkage between American domestic policy and foreign policy. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I wasn't, do you remember that point?
Yeah, I was thinking, there's a poster, I remember seeing a poster, I was working on my dissertation at Cornell University and I was staying with someone there, and I remember he had a poster, and it was a quote from, actually two posters. One was something about freedom is the same Mississippi and Vietnam, freedom is the same everywhere. And the other poster was a quote from Lyndon Johnson that is, if you want to know what America does abroad or something, look at what America does at home. And, you know, it started me thinking about it. And for those of us who were coming of age politically in that time, how could the U.S., I mean, the U.S. did, but I'm just saying the questions that came up, you know, how could John Kennedy go to the Berlin Wall in 1961 and proclaim his solidarity with the oppressed people in East Berlin and not go to Mississippi in 1961 or 62 and walk black kids to school, or show up in October of 62 with, I'm blanking at his name, the Air Force veteran, James Meredith, who tried to enroll at the University of Mississippi, which caused an incredible riot. A couple of people were killed. It took federal troops and marshals. And those kinds of things, for me, indicate that there is a link between the face of the government abroad and the face of the government at home, because it would seem to me that you could not be abroad killing and marauding black, brown, and yellow people if you did not start with a racist assumption here at home. That does not mean that there might not be foreign concerns and conflicts. But Malcolm X, so I was just listening to a CD by Malcolm X, a speech he gave in 1965, shortly before he died, called The Ballot or the Bullet. It was at the Church of the Black Madonna in Detroit, Michigan, and he was talking about the U.S. being in Vietnam, and given what was happening to black people at home, what are we doing in Vietnam? And so that's the link that I think it's oppression at home. What's happened closest to home that essentially shapes how you then go out into the world. And I'm using home in a sense of your own home, because we know tragically, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere, the home is a violent place, especially for children and especially for women, and female children, and that it's from that place people go forward. And how could you do this to your partner and your child and then go forward in the world and say, you know, I'm really concerned about the Iraqis, or I love poor children in Africa, etc. That's the link, I think. Not that there aren't contradictions in that link, but it's almost like an invisible thread that goes back and forth. And so when we look at the worst in this country and the best, but if you mention the hurricane in terms of the amazing images, and the racism and classism that profoundly shaped this natural disaster into a social disaster. That's also, I would argue, if you look at U.S. foreign policy, the face of the United States in Southern Africa, in Vietnam, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, against people of color. So that's how I'd make the link.
Thank you. A quick comment about the reading. The one thing that struck me was that someone like Debs, who was trying to get his union, the railway union, but also all of labor, to extend itself beyond the regular race lines. You know, he became more of a visionary figure. What came to me was that the Native Americans, you know, you have these figures, especially someone as early, maybe most famous is Tecumseh, you know, like 1810, 1812, that kind of thing. But even before that, there was a King Philip, you know, King Philip's War in 1675, but the Plymouth Rock, that whole Plymouth Plantation. But these figures, they were trying to get the other Native American tribes to extend their view beyond the animosity between tribe and tribe. I mean, this is so, it's interesting to me, the association of that. You know, these first visionaries were actually our Native American visionaries.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point.
You know, and Tecumseh especially. I mean, and yet that seems to be, and even someone, really, I guess most recently, it would be King, because King did have that kind of vision. He was about all people getting together. He really was. And it's that vision that most of us don't get. You know, we don't get.
I don't look upon the collapse of Russia as a failure in socialism. I look upon it as an economic failure caused by corruption. And I don't see much difference between whether, and if George Bush bankrupts this country, I don't see much difference between the collapse of Russia and what may happen to the U.S.
No, that's a good point. I mean, in terms of the question that was asked before, and in the comment I made, because one of the things I've been doing, and maybe it's my way of depressing myself, but is especially going back and reading and rereading many histories of the Cold War, and especially histories of the 1940s and the atomic bombings in Japan, and I'm reading a marvelous book now called By the Bomb's Early Light. It's a book about culture in the United States in the atomic era. And when you look at the whole struggle between the U.S. and the USSR, even pre-1917, but essentially bankrupting the Soviet Union into an arms race, which created a collapse in a country that had 20 million killed in World War II, maybe 50 million homeless, virtually the entire country, all the way to the east to Moscow, devastated. And every experiment, Noam Chomsky's written about this, every single experiment undertaken by every single society since 1917 to develop a different economic perspective, more social democracy, socialism, whatever you want to call it, not necessarily capitalist. Every single country that attempted that has been attacked by the United States, either militarily and or economically. You cannot name a single country, not the Soviet Union, not China, not the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. There's been a 46-year war against the Cuban people. It's an economic war, and that is an act of war under international treaties, by the way. The Vietnamese, okay. So we don't know what might have happened under a decent evolution of a society that might have taken a different path and had to deal with its own political contradictions in terms of repression politically, et cetera, et cetera. We just don't know that, and we can't speculate on that. But we do know, I mean, under Woodrow Wilson, the US, the French, and the British sent troops, invaded the Soviet Union, and fought on the side of the White Army against the Red Army. I mean, think of the reverse. That would be, you know, some country after we had had our revolution, if it was a revolution, whatever you want to call it here, sending an army in to go after the colonies. We wouldn't forget that. And the Soviet citizens I met when I lived there for 4 months, they knew that. And every single person, especially older person that I met, remembered World War II. Had a person in his or her family dead, missing, homeless. And I was there in 1984. I was there during the Reagan-Mondale election. And it was an amazing time to be there because people were frightened to hell about a nuclear war, etc. So we don't know. We don't know what would have happened totally if the Sandinista revolution had been allowed to flower. Though we do know before they were attacked, dramatic changes were made in literacy, health, and other opportunities for people, just as happened in Cuba, despite the U.S. And so it's, you know, people say, well, this, you know, socialism doesn't work, this doesn't work. It's never been allowed to work. It's never been allowed to work. And again, to go back to your issue about in people's own interest, those who do have power in this society could not allow it to work. I mean, that's Noam Chomsky's argument. If that virus catches on around the world, and countries do, and as now is happening in Venezuela. Now, you know I mean, well, we already tried to pull off a coup in Venezuela, and then the whole stuff with the election. Chavez was at the UN this past week. He's saying the U.S. is actually planning an invasion. They're probably trying to assassinate him. Who knows? I mean, we don't know because, but we can go on past history. I mean, if that virus catches on throughout the Americas, and if this guy keeps selling heating oil and gasoline at below market prices to poor neighborhoods in the U.S., I mean, what is this guy, crazy or what? So who knows? And that's going to have to be settled by the Venezuelan people, not by us. But we've never allowed that, not we, but they've never allowed that to happen. And just everything I read about the absolute critical moment in 1945, 46, the whole history of the last 55 years could have been dramatically different. We had 13 atomic bombs, the Soviet Union had none, and they could have stopped the production and development of atomic bombs at that moment. The U.S. was not going to give up its lead, and we're lucky. I mean, we're just lucky. We still have about 10,000, and I don't know how many of the Russians have.
I was wanting to comment on that whole thing, too, that was started earlier. It was pointed out to me that when socialist society had to produce a tank, it took away from the system. It took away from their system, and their people had to do without other things that they needed. While over here, it made the capitalist class even richer. When they made a tank, they made the money, and there was the thing that was on the internet about bin Laden and the CIA reports on bin Laden in Afghanistan, and that they said that they, even though they knew bin Laden was a danger to the United States, that they still wanted to support him because he was helping the collapse of the Soviet Union move along faster because the Soviet Union had to put more money into weaponry and things of that nature. So the two economic systems were basically different, and a lot of the problems they had was because of what we were doing to them. Going all the way back to the question of Marx, one of the most people that have influenced me in ideas over the years that I've read, two of them, one of them was Karl Marx, and it was more to do with not even the economics, but more the dialectical materialism, the thought process, that how to analyze things. So the other person happens to be Charles Darwin, which basically, because I had started off with a background in zoology, and that basically is the basis for analyzing biological organisms, the whole question of the theory of evolution, things of that nature. A young friend of mine who's a professor at UCLA in zoology knows people like Edmund Wilson, Stephen Jay Gould, Dawkins, so on and so forth, and he said to me, he says, they're all Marxists. He says they won't admit it publicly, but he says they're all Marxists in their way they think.
Yeah.
Because it's the methodology of the thought process of being able to analyze something, rather than just looking at it the way we have always been taught to look at things, but the way things, how things change, and how everything always has to change. If it doesn't change, it dies. The Soviet Union wasn't able to change because the forces were going against it too fastly. It died. Everything else, the same thing, process of growth and change.
And it had, far beyond our discussion, but there's serious political and economic problems also internal to the Soviet Union and bureaucracy, and all of us know. So, I mean, that's part of it too. And it's interesting, I mean, of course, The Origin of the Species, Darwin and Marx's Capital, both published in 1859, the same year. Should ask Hans next time, where was Darwin on that list of the millennium? I mean, he had to be up there. Maybe he was number three, like Babe Ruth, and then could figure out who would be Lou Gehrig, number four. Forgot to ask Hans, that is, who put this list together? Of course, that always shapes who's on the list, right? I mean, we'll give you the last word here, Jeffrey. It's time to go home.
Okay. Not too much of a last word, except that there are a few books that I'd like to share that I've read recently that really kind of showed me how the nuts and the bolts of how America, the American government, really takes control of popular movements throughout the world. And you've probably heard of the guy, John Perkins, Confession of a Hitman. I've read the book and I urge you to read it because he really just dots the I's and crosses the T's of how it's done. You know the CIA is doing these things, but he shows in detail how it's done, and it was very informative. And the other thing is I've been going on a Michael Pareny jag for the last two weeks. I've read four or five of his books.
Ooh.
And History is Mystery is just a tremendous book. And anybody who wants a really good read, those books are really, really good.
Yeah, I second that. I read the Confessions of an Economic Hitman because this guy Perkins was on the inside. So he actually was doing some of these things. And of course, Parenti's books over time and the CDs are marvelous. And we should send good vibes to Michael because he's really got a bad back problem and he's had to cancel some talks. Checked his website. He's got a serious back problem. And so having suffered from back problems over my life, we started to send him little hints to do. And working on a book on religion, by the way. And as a lapsed Catholic, only Michael can probably do a job on the Catholic Church. Okay, some of us are going, you got to make a short announcement.
I'm actually mounting parallel elections in every county in the state for the special election. Parallel elections are people just vote on a paper ballot and have it hand counted that citizens request them to do. I did five of these in San Diego and 50% participated in one place in spite of four cop cars.
So you'll send me an email in the morning.
And then if it's okay with you, you'll know Judy Alter.
Yeah.
You know, electronic voting is rigged. It's rigged. Schwarzenegger didn't win. He only won on Diebold. It's rigged. And we have to demonstrate it, and we can do it by paper ballots, hand-counted. And then one more point. We're training the state to do this parallel election process because I promised the people in the election justice movement that I would, I don't know how to do this, but get on the ballot for 206, a constitutional amendment to have hand-counted paper ballots at the precinct in California. 18 states are going to try it to take back the election machinery. You know, if we don't win at the ballot box, at least we ought to have a ballot box, because we don't have it now. And so we're training the state and all the people doing a parallel election. It's one-day commitment, because we're going to have to count the hand paper, you know, the initiative, because they're not going to let it win. So that's what I'm trying to do. No, I'm going to do it, no trying. And if you know anybody or any friends or relatives or cousins or students, let me know. And the whole state. So if you have places, people, I'm looking for teams now.
And remember, during that coming election, vote early and vote often. Okay.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's presentation of Robber Barons, Rebels, and the Socialist Challenge. Commentary and discussion of chapters 11 and 13 of People's History. The group met on September 20th of 2005. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.